I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester, his name is John Anilio, and you're listening to The Functional Nerds. This is going to be episode number 239.
That is Patrick Hester. He's an author, a blogger, and a Hugo Award-winning podcaster for the SF Signal podcast. You can check out his website, atfmb.com, and follow him on Twitter, at atfmb.
And John, thanks for always mentioning the Hugo thing. Believe it or not, I forget to mention it.
I'd be introducing myself as Hugo Award-winning John Anilio when I went to parties and stuff. But most of the people that I hang out with, they'd be like, what's a Hugo?
Right.
You know, in our community, that means a big deal. But in our daily lives, not so much. Yeah. But, you know, what are you going to do? Anyway, I'm John Anilio. I'm a musician and a podcaster. You can check out my website, johnanilio.com, and follow me on Twitter at John Anilio. And how are you doing this week, Patrick?
I'm doing pretty well. I never intended to live in Seattle. But with all the rainfall that we're getting in Denver, it feels like Seattle. We've always boasted in Denver that you get 350 plus days of sunshine or something like that has been the touristy thing that we've always talked about. And that record is in danger because of all the rain and snow that we've gotten so far this year.
Mm, interesting.
Meanwhile, we have tons of water. You know, our reservoirs and canals and everything are all, you know, just running like crazy. And so tons and tons of water, which doesn't make the people in California any happier. But it's been kind of crazy here lately.
Yeah. Yeah. So the last couple of weeks we've had some fresh interviews with a few authors. We're going to go back to a Pikes Peak. Patrick, you must have been really busy at Pikes Peak because you've run a couple of those over at SF Signal.
Yes.
Too, right?
Here's what's funny. Here's what is actually hilarious. So over on SF Signal, I did an interview with Dave Gross. Mm-hmm. And if you know Dave Gross, he's a cool dude. And he writes a lot of tie-in fiction, a lot of different novels.
Yeah, I got his most recent Pathfinder. Tor sent it to me because Paizo and Tor, or Tor is publishing Paizo now. And
yeah, it's funny because Paizo made a point of sending me every Pathfinder Tales book.
Wow.
Because I know James Sutter and I've been a huge, huge proponent of them. Tor doesn't send me shit. So I didn't get the Pathfinder Tales book from Tor, and Dave was like upset about that. He's like, "Oh, I can't believe they didn't send you the book." And I'm like, "Yeah, you know, Tor doesn't really send me that much stuff." So I thought that was kind of funny that'll probably be the first Tor or the first Pathfinder book I don't get. Hmm. Whatever.
I can send you my copy when I'm done.
But we were talking about going to cons and recording interviews, which is something that I do. Mm-hmm. But it's funny. I said, yeah. He says, well, you could get a ton of content at one con. You know, you could be flush for months. And I said, yeah. The only problem with that is the two Johns. Mm-hmm. And he's like, the two Johns. And I said, yeah. There's John Anilio and John DiNardo, my podcasting people. And what happens is when I go to a con and I record a bunch of interviews, they're very excited that I've gotten all this great content. And then about 6 weeks later, it's like, really? You're still pushing out interviews from that? How many more do you have?
Well, you know, if you were, it's true. It's true because part of me is always like, oh, sweet. I don't have to do that much work. And then I'm like, hey, I miss being on the podcast as much as I would like to be. So yeah, it is a balance. It is nice. But really, if you were a podcaster doing your own thing, you can literally go to maybe like four cons in a year and have a year's worth of content if you really hustled over the weekend.
Yeah. You know, I just like to be busy at a con. I don't like to be idle, you know, and it helps me to focus when I'm at a con, if I'm doing interviews, because I've had bad con experiences before. And Reno, for example, for me was a horrible con experience, and it wasn't just the buses going back and forth, you know, at Worldcon between the different con hotels. It was pretty spread out. So that particular con, everybody wasn't all together in one spot. There were multiple hotels, and then you had the convention center, and there was buses running, and sometimes they were running on schedule, and sometimes they weren't, and there was all this stuff going on, and it it became this overwhelming thing for me, and I couldn't find the people that I knew. I didn't know where anything was going on. There were parties happening, but I didn't know in what hotel they were in. So there was a lot of things contributing to my not having a good convention experience there. And one of it was also I didn't really set up interviews beforehand. I had a couple, but they weren't like really, really set. Like I knew where we were going to meet and all this kind of stuff. And so that just contributed to me having a really bad con experience. And to this day, I tell people Worldcon in Reno was the worst Worldcon I've ever been to. And it's not because of the con people. It's not because of the content of the con. It's none of that stuff. It's just my personal experience that I had there. So when I go to cons or conferences or any of this stuff, I like to structure stuff during the day. And so I know, you know, I'm going to be meeting Brent Weeks at, you know, such and such time, and we're going to go do this. And I like, you know, and when I have that, it just makes it a better con experience for me overall. So I love to go and be able to be face-to-face and do interviews with people. And I actually have to dial myself back, because otherwise, John, I would have more.
Yeah. Well, and I was going to say, you know, with going to a con, and especially if you're going on your own dime, if, you know, because things can break in so many different ways depending on the con. And if maybe you're not on a lot of panels, or you see some panels, you're like, why am I not on that panel? Like, I'm perfect for that. Or they put you on one where you're like, why am I on this panel? I have no idea. You know, and that happens all the time, mm-hmm. you know, when you're, so if you go to a con, and especially if you're paying for it out of your pocket, or maybe you're, if you're, because I don't know if people know this, but for those of you who attend cons, or maybe you haven't, if you are this has been my experience, and I haven't been to a million of them, but if you are a guest, like if you're someone that's on the panels, you usually get your like your con fee is taken care of, which could range anywhere from like $50 to like $200 or $300, depending on the con you're going to. So that can be significant. But if it's not in your town, you have to handle your travel and your hotel. And depending on the town you're in, your travel and hotel can be quite costly. Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking, you know, hundreds, if not well over $1,000. So if you're going to a con, even for someone like me, I would go to Balticon. I haven't been to Balticon in a couple of years. I live in New Jersey. It's about a 4-hour drive. So not too bad. But, you know, tolls, gas adds up. The hotel is not cheap. You know, I'd spend $300-$500 maybe. I don't know, something like that when you have meals and everything. And if you go to something like that and you don't walk away with a lot of interviews, you didn't really end up on the panels that you would have liked, and you're like, why did I spend all this money to come? Like, that was not worth it. Whereas if you're doing the podcast and you ahead of time get, you know, anywhere from 4 to 10 interviews in, no matter how much you spent, no matter how maybe panels went, you're like, I got a bunch of interviews for the show. So it was totally worth it to go then.
And
so I get it.
And I'm not like really exaggerating it. I'm literally telling you, like, DiNardo in the past has been, did you have a good con? Yeah. I got, you know, 10 interviews. Oh, that's awesome. And then around interview 7, you're still putting those out, really?
Yeah.
You know, cool. it's hilarious. So
it's funny how podcasts kind of like, you know, wax and wane in that way, because there are times where I'm like, we should do 2 shows a week, or or we should add another show, or I should do another show, or you should do another show. We've actually talked about that. But you know, so there are weeks like that, and then there are weeks like, oh man, we need to get a show together for this week. You know, it's funny how it works. It's like, you know, drought or a flood. You know,
feast or famine. Yeah,
yeah.
And you mentioned when someone kind of offsets some of your costs. Mm-hmm. So not every con can do that for every panelist, mm-hmm. but there have been. You know, Mile High Con is pretty good about it. But for example, I pay for my membership every year at Mile High Con, and I tell them not to refund it to me or not to do anything, because, you know, it's a volunteer run con, and I know they can't afford to pay every panelist. So, mm-hmm. you know, or it's not really paying the panelist. It's just cutting waiving the fee. Thanks. Mm-hmm. With something like Pikes Peak Writers or like something like Capricorn, where, you know, there's a lot of cost involved with you coming there, and they're waiving some of that, then I feel obligated to do more.
Sure.
And so, you know, we talked about this at Capricorn. I was doing a lot. I was meeting with people in the game room. I was running around and going to other panels, and I was interacting, and I was doing all kinds of stuff to be a real ambassador for Capricorn, because I really appreciated that they had invited me. Well, Pikes Peak Writers makes a point of inviting me, and I helped them out a little bit by doing some pre-con interviews with some of their keynotes or guests who are going to be there and kind of talk about it. And I also, when I'm there, I structure, or I have them structure it so that I can do as many interviews as possible, because I want to help them grow that conference. Now, over on SF Signal, I am doing a similar thing with the Gen Con Writers Symposium. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people don't know that Gen Con has essentially a writer's conference inside it as part of the overall con. And it's called the Gen Con Writers Symposium. And a lot of people come there, and it's not just science fiction and fantasy people. It's not just role-playing people. It's also romance writers and mystery writers and general fiction people, because of the content that happens there. So, you know, when someone like that comes to me and says, hey, we would love for you to do some interviews and kind of help us promote this, I'm totally willing to do that.
Mm-hmm. Hey, John Bivens, who's an artist, we went to every party. And we drank people's beers and wine. So, you know, I don't want to hear that I'm not working hard at these cons, because Bivens and I, we did the rounds, man.
Yes, you did.
I'm joking, but they were the heads of the con were just like, I think it's so awesome that you guys made appearances everywhere, because people really, and like, I don't know, we're just, I'm a podcaster, not that there's any sort of celebrity involved in what we do, but they were sort of appreciative that we weren't just locking ourselves in our room.
Sure.
We
no at Capricorn we had a different batch, and so they really did like when we showed up at any of the parties. It's like the party people, to them, that was thrilling, and that's cool, you know?
Yeah.
And if you are into different kinds of beers and different kinds of drinks and mixed drinks and all that kind of stuff, Capricorn is a great con for you, because they had people set up, you know, like microbrew parties and...
Oh, yeah, and there was, I think it's called Bar Fleet,
yeah,
I believe
Bar Fleet was there. So,
Barfleet is like this whole thing where they go to different cons, and it's basically just like it's like an organization. I'm not joking.
I know.
It's like a big thing. It's really cool.
they have to card you as you're going in, and it was interesting because the captain mm-hmm. of the ship was there, and he looked at me, and he's like, we have to card everybody. And I'm like, Captain, my captain, you know, mm-hmm. It was just hilarious. But it's like structured like Starfleet, but it's Barfleet.
So yeah, and it's funny. Those parties are fun. And I went to take a selfie of me and Bevins, and they were like, whoa, no pictures. I was like, okay, sorry. I'm not taking, and that's cool. They want people to just sort of unwind and have a good time. And, you know, everyone's got their day. And it was cool. Not that anything crazy was going on. People were just drinking and dancing. It was fine. But anyway, all right, well, let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And I will pick first, and I'm going to pick a book that, depending on when this airs, I don't know if it's out yet. It is a collection of short stories, and it is by John Joseph Adams and Daniel H. Wilson. I know this John Joseph Adams guy is really making a name for himself in the anthologies. He's done a million of them, but this one is called Press Start to Play. And as you can guess from the title, all of these stories are sort of about video games and about our relationship with video games. And I am not a gamer. I was a huge video game player when I was younger, when I was a kid, but I didn't really keep up with it. But for some reason lately, I've been sort of interested in sort of the cultural impact of video games. I still have, other than playing the Wii with my son, we had a rousing game of Mario Kart this morning. But other than that, I really haven't played video games seriously, not like a lot of other people that I know that have really kind of kept up with it. But this is an really cool, and I don't read a lot of short stories, but this is great. Almost all of the stories were really excellent. Some really good ones by Holly Black and Shauna McGuire, and Daniel H. Wilson's story was very good in this. And Ernie Klein wrote the intro for it. So it's really good. I really liked it a lot. If you liked Ready Player One, a lot of the short stories are kind of like that. you know, have that same sort of flavor. But everything is really different sort of take on video games and our relationship with it. So if you like video games and you like anthologies, you are really going to like this one. So it's called Press Start to Play. It's by John Joseph. It's edited by John Joseph Adams and Daniel H. Wilson. And I think you'll dig it. So that is my pick this week.
Very cool.
Yeah. How about you, Patrick?
My pick this week is Ceres, the largest object in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter.
Hmm.
And it's considered a dwarf planet. And the reason I'm picking it is because it's making a lot of news right now, because NASA's Dawn spacecraft has been approaching Ceres for a while and has been taking tons of photos as it's coming in. And so you get like really blurry ones and they start to come into focus as it's getting closer and closer. And not too long ago, a photo of Ceres made a big buzz on the internet because it's, you know, they're these black and white pictures, right? So you it's basically almost like a grayscale kind of photo. And in one of the craters are these two giant white dots.
Mm.
And everybody was like, holy crap, what's that? You know, what's essentially something is reflecting in this crater. And they're not sure what it is. And it's the only thing reflecting on the surface. And so they continue to take pictures. And just a couple days ago, they got even closer pictures now. And they can see that it's not like really two giant white dots. It's a series of things that are reflecting. And they're still not sure what it is. They're kind of leaning towards some sort of ice or it could be something like something impacted the surface, because it looks like there could be some black marks there as well. So it's almost like something has impacted the surface of the crater and took away the surface layer of rock to reveal ice underneath, like permafrost almost underneath the layer of the planet, of the dust and rock and everything. So it's just really cool to be able to watch that happening and to see NASA's, you know, kind of going, huh, well, we weren't expecting that. Mm-hmm. So yeah. it's cool. And, you know, at the same time, I've read 4 out of the 5 Expanse novels.
I was just going to say that.
Ceres plays a huge part in that, yes. Because in those books, the Outer Planets Alliance operates off of Ceres now. And Ceres has basically been hollowed out and spun up. So it's spinning and it has a level of gravity, and the interior is just full of 6 million people. 6 million people live on Ceres in the Expanse universe. So, you know, to be reading those books and then see Dawn approaching and having this kind of stuff going on and this little mystery, you know, about what's going on there, because that could mean that there's other ice patches and there could be water. You know, frozen water there, because we don't know what the ice is. There could be water somewhere underneath the surface of Ceres that's frozen. So it's just all really interesting stuff.
It's going to come to light that this is just a hoax perpetrated by James S.A. Corey as a way to help promote the new TV series.
Could come out that it's the proto-monocule. I mean, we never know.
You never know. Cool. All right. who do we have on the show this week?
This week is my interview with Laura DeSilverio. And Laura is a retired Air Force intelligence officer. She's got 15 books under her belt, which is really impressive. The whole Air Force intelligence thing, since we were in Colorado Springs, I have to ask if I can get access to the Stargate. And of course, she denied me access to the Stargate while also denying the actual existence of the Stargate. So that continues to be a trend with the people that I meet in Colorado Springs, because the Air Force Academy is there and NORAD and all that kind of stuff, Cheyenne Mountain. So they continue to deny the access of the Stargate, or to the Stargate, and the actual existence of the Stargate, for crying out loud. I don't get it. Anyway, she has written 15 books. They are essentially mysteries. And what's really interesting to me is I would have expected you to write books in like the spy genre or something like that. And she's like, I can't. Well, I could, but if I did, everything I write would have to be vetted by the Pentagon and the Air Force, because it's that whole thing where if you've been in the military and you've handled classified materials, you can't. you can't tell your life story. You can't say certain things. They kind of have to read everything before and say yes or no to make sure that you're not giving away anything. So that was super interesting to me. And she is the president of the Sisters of Crime. She writes articles for Writer's Digest. She has done all kinds of stuff. She teaches for the Mystery University workshops at the MWA and for all kinds of different places. So she was really kind of a fun, interesting interview, and I hope everybody likes it. I'm here at the Pikes Peaks Writers Conference 2015, and my guest is Laura, and Laura is going to pronounce her name for me because I can't do it.
Di Silverio.
Di Silverio. Okay.
There you go.
Well, I think it was there's a D, and then there's a little I, and then there's S, and then in Jason's email to me, it was a D, a little I, a little S, but a big I or an L, and I'm going, it doesn't match the website, and now I'm confused.
No, I think that must have just been a typo.
And Laura, what do you do? I mean, what do you write?
I write crime fiction.
Crime fiction, okay.
I've got a couple of cozy series. I've got a humorous PI series. And then in September, I have a standalone suspense novel coming from Midnight Ink.
Wow.
So 13 books out. Two more coming out this year. Another couple next year. So it keeps me off the streets.
And what's your background? I mean, were you a cop or something? Is that why you wanted to get into crime fiction or...
I was an Air Force intelligence officer.
Oh. So you know where the Stargate is.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
We are in Colorado Springs. Uh-huh. I mean, come on.
Uh-huh. The Stargate and all the alien bodies are hid, et cetera, et cetera. No, I graduated with a degree in English from Trinity University and looked around for a job and had a few little anxiety attacks,
mm-hmm,
and couldn't figure out what I was going to do. Since my father had been an Air Force pilot and I was very comfortable in the military milieu, I ran my little anxiety-ridden body down to the recruiter and said, "Do you want me? Please say you want me." And he said, "Well, we have openings in public affairs and intelligence for someone, you know, with your qualifications and background." I said, intelligence? That sounds kind of James Bondy and mm-hmm, sexy and cool. Sign me up." And so they signed me up, and they sent me off to training, and 20 years later, I retired.
So for 20 years, you sat at a desk staring at a screen looking at data?
No. Although, you know,
there's a lot more along that line than it is along the James Bond
sexy cars and gadgets
right
kind of line. No, I did everything from intelligence work with air crews, on a flight line in Korea.
Wow.
To stuff with spy satellites with the National Reconnaissance Office, to staff work at the Pentagon, legislative liaison, taught at the Air Force Academy for 3 years.
Wow.
You know, so the best thing about it was, you know, just about the time I was getting bored with a job, boom, they moved me to a new city, a new country, gave me something new to learn. It was a great, you know, great fodder for my writing now. Not that I write spy stuff or intelligence, but just all the people you meet and the situations you're in and the settings you've got to draw from.
Mm-hmm. So it did inform your writing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there are times I think, okay, if I had been brave enough to say I'm going to be a novelist when I walked out of college at 21, where would I be today? You know, my name would be Janet Ivanovich Patterson Rowling, maybe. But, you know, I wouldn't have been the writer then that I am now because I wouldn't have had the experiences that I've had. So,
sure,
you know, when kids ask me, oh, should I go to school and major in English if I want to be a writer? I say, not unless English is the one thing in the world you're most passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go be a biologist. Go be a computer code doer person. Go be a mathematician or a social worker. And then use that to feed your writing.
So did you have to go through the Air Force Academy here?
I did not.
I went
through officer training school,
okay,
which is a 90-day kind of, here's how you be an Air Force officer. You know, the Air Force Academy is also college.
Sure.
So you do OTS after you've done college. So.
Oh, so you already had the credit from having gone through college and getting
right
a degree. Okay, gotcha. So, but then you came back to the Air Force Academy and taught.
I did. They brought me back mid-career. I taught in the English department for 3 years. They sent me off for an Ivy League master's degree. So thank you, taxpayers, in literature. And I taught composition and literature and public speaking at the Air Force Academy for 3 years. Loved it.
I find it interesting. Last year, one of the keynotes was someone who had been a investigative journalist for years and years and years before she started writing books. And so her books...
Is this Hank?
Yeah.
Philip Ryan, yeah. She's a buddy.
And so you know, her career totally informed her
Absolutely.
Books, and that's the books she started writing. Mm-hmm. You're not writing spy novels and intelligence. You never felt like, you know, you never picked up a Jack Ryan book and thought, hey, this is what I want to write. You went Agatha Christie mystery novel kind of thing.
Well, funny story there. I initially started out with an Air Force intelligence captain as my protagonist. They
okay.
say, you know, write what you know.
Sure.
It wasn't a spy sort of thing, but mm-hmm. I had an Air Force intelligence officer as my protagonist. I thought, this could be really cool. You know, she can move to exotic new locations every 3 years or so and, you know, kind of show readers a glimpse of another world. And that book landed me an agent, but we never sold it.
Hmm.
I wrote two in that series, never sold it. And as to the spy sort of stuff, you know, my problem there is the security clearances that I've held. I can't write that stuff.
Oh, if anything came too close to something that actually ever happened, you'd get in trouble.
Absolutely.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And I would have to submit everything I wrote along those lines for security clearance before it could be published. And it's not fear of going to jail that keeps me from doing
yes.
it. It's the fact that I signed away my rights to royalties if they decide that I have broken my non-disclosure agreements.
That's fascinating. I remember something about that. Like, weren't they going after one of the SEAL team members who wrote a book?
They were.
He didn't get it cleared first.
Yep.
Because of all his that's fascinating.
Yeah.
You never think about that. You think, oh, you know, you're going to go into intelligence or military service and then write a book after, you know, write a memoir. Maybe mm-hmm. something sparks you, and you can't really do that because of classified stuff.
Yeah, you can't do it if you're ethical.
Sure. Wow. That's a trip.
Yeah.
You know, I had the fragment of a memory on that, but until you said it just now, it never dawned on me. So you went the mystery route.
I went the mystery route. It's what I tend to read, mystery, suspense, crime fiction, across the spectrum. I read other things as well. I read some fantasy. I read women's fiction. I read beach reads. But I really like the puzzle in the mysteries. I like the intellectual challenge of it.
Sure.
Both as a reader and as a writer. I like constructing the puzzle.
So okay, tell me about your books. You have The Readaholics and the Falcon Fiasco.
The Readaholics and the Falcon Fiasco just debuted a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a national bestseller on the
Barnes
& Noble list.
Wow, congratulations.
So thank you. Yes, very exciting. It is the first in a new series, the Mystery Book Club series. It is set in my fictional town of Heaven, Colorado, which is over on the west side of the state. And my protagonist is an event organizer. So lots of weddings, because mm-hmm. who doesn't want to have their marriage start in
sure.
heaven, even if it all goes downhill from there? The town fathers actually renamed the town of Walters Ford to Heaven because they wanted to attract the destination wedding business.
Wow.
So that's how the town came to be. And Amy Faye, my event organizer, has four friends, and the five of them are the Readaholics. And they read classic mysteries primarily, occasionally something more modern.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first book, they're reading The Maltese Falcon. And kind of the hook is that something from the book they're reading will work into the mystery they're solving in each book.
Life imitating art.
Yeah, you know, or at least pinging against it on occasion. And in the first book, one of their group members is poisoned. And so they employ some Sam Spade tactics to figure out what happened.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I have a good time with it. The second one comes out in December. And that's called The Readaholics and the Poirot Puzzle. And so obviously we're reading Agatha Christie.
Hercule Poirot. Yeah, one of my grandmother's favorites.
Yeah.
Yes. She always read the Agatha Christies, and then she really loved the BBC adaptations that would show mm-hmm. up on PBS.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Masterpiece Theater and
right.
stuff like that. She loved it. She just ate that stuff up.
Yeah.
So when did the first book come out?
April 7th.
And the second book is coming out in December. That's a pretty fast turnaround.
Pretty standard with this publisher. They like to space them at about 9 months mm-hmm. When they can.
So you drink a lot of coffee?
I don't. I drink two cups of tea in the morning. And then, unfortunately, I have to cut out the caffeine unless I want to be up till 4 the next morning.
I'm just trying to think of, that's a lot of writing and it's a lot of fast. And are you? Do you work on other things at the same time?
I do. I'm usually only drafting one book at a time, but and I'll do that in the morning. The morning is my creative time. So I get up at 5:30 or 5:45. I walk the dog, take the kids to school, and I sit down and I write. And I do 2,000 words a day mm-hmm. when I'm drafting, or till noon, whichever is later. So sometimes I get 2,000 words in 2 hours, and sometimes it's, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm and I'm checking the word count every sentence. Okay, 1,942 type of sentence. 1,958. Yeah, some days it flows, some days it doesn't, but I do the 2,000 regardless. And then I might come home and work on some other aspect of a different project. I might be outlining, you know, thinking about a different book. I might be doing copy edits or typeset edits. Come back and I do, you know, the social media sort of marketing stuff.
Sure.
I can only draft one book at a time, but I'm usually have two or three in some stage.
So if you've just launched a new series, are you still writing in other series?
I am not writing any of the series that are out there right now.
Okay.
I had my Swift Investigation series with Minotaur, the Mall Cop series with Berkeley Prime Crime, and I wrote a Ballroom Dancing mystery series as Ella Barrick for the publisher that does the Readaholics, NAL. But those appear to have trickled off.
Okay. Well, it happens.
So not writing. Yeah, it happens. I'm hoping the Readaholics is kind of going to catch on. I'm working on a YA trilogy at the moment. Mm-hmm. So just like to reach out and try new things and challenge myself. And
well, tell our listeners a little bit about the other series. I mean, they might want to still go out there and check them out and try to find them.
I can tell them about those. Swift Investigations is humorous private investigator. Mm-hmm. I like
a humorous private investigator. His name is Harry Dresden.
Oh, yeah, that's a lot darker than my humorous private investigator. Yeah, well, I don't have demons and vampires and people being, you know,
uh-huh.
killed and mutilated and
all. But he does it with
thing.
A snappy quip.
So. He does. There's a snappy quip there, but I prefer my snappy quips with without a side of
without the
dismemberment.
Dark magic. Yes, without the dark magic. Understood.
Yeah. I do enjoy the books, but I don't want to write them. So my snappy quips come courtesy of Charlotte Swift, who is former Air Force OSI investigator who left the Air Force under somewhat murky circumstances and has set up for herself as a private investigator as a solo operative, because one of the things she hated about the military was that whole team sort of garbage, and doesn't want to partner, so she didn't want to be a cop. So she set up on her own, and through a series of circumstances, she ends up with middle-aged, 55-year-old, plump, pampered divorcee as her partner, Gigi Goldman.
Hmm.
And so a large part of the humor comes from, you know, the conflict that arises as they try to work together. But they solve, you know, meaty mysteries. They're real mysteries here. It's not... I wouldn't say it's a slapstick as, they say, a Janet Ivanovich or something.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of humor along the way.
And what's OSI?
Oh, sorry, Office of Special Investigations.
Okay.
It's kind of, Charlie tells people that she's, that was the Air Force equivalent of Mark Harmon's NCIS.
Oh, yeah. My mom loves Mark Harmon.
Yeah, NCIS without Mark Harmon is what she calls the OSI.
Yeah, it's... Yeah. My mom's obsession with Mark Harmon and NCIS is borderline creepy.
Does she like the new one?
Yes.
Scott Bakula?
Yes, she does. But I can't watch it because I keep wanting him to...
Leap into some other...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I wasn't a fan of Enterprise, really.
Yeah, no.
But, yeah, I keep... And the accent is really hard on him. I don't...
Oh, and it's even harder on Lucas Black in that show. I can hardly understand a word he's saying.
Yeah. So it's like... It's like when they launched CSI New York.
Mm-hmm.
There was one guy on there whose New York accent was so terrible that I was just like, why are they letting him do that? Wasn't somebody talking to him about that? But yeah, that's a completely different story. So that sounds like a fun series. And how many books are out in that?
There are three.
Okay.
In that series, Swift Justice, Swift Edge, and Swift Run. Yeah, there were a couple of them were Lefty Award finalists for best humorous mystery
of
the year. Yeah, they're a lot of fun. They're a good time. They're set here in Colorado Springs.
Oh, okay. Now, do you live in the Springs?
I do live in the Springs.
Okay.
Then I have a Mall Cop series
mm-hmm.
where...
Is it Paul Blart?
No fat, overweight guys on Segways. I have actually a disabled former Army cop who was injured by an IED. Mm-hmm. Still wants to be a cop, but she can't pass the physical. You know, she's been medically retired from the military, and so she takes a job as a mall cop in what she thinks of as a temporary kind of gonna work on my knee, I'm gonna rehab, I'm gonna keep applying to police departments, and eventually I'm gonna be a real cop again. And well, of course, you know, we want the series to keep going, so she's going to meet with eternal disappointment on the become a real cop thing. But it's she works in Fern Glen Galleria, which is a very dysfunctional mall out in Virginia that nobody's ever going to want to go to because, of course, dead bodies keep turning up. And she, her grandfather, her grandpa Atherton, lives in the area, and he's a retired CIA operative in his 80s. And he gets his jollies by buying all the latest spy gadgets off the net and then trying them out at the mall. And so she tries to ride herd on him and keep from getting in trouble because of his antics, and tries to take her job as a mall cop seriously. And of course, the level of competence is not necessarily really high. And so there's a lot of humor in that as well.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Yeah, there's a kind of the which man is she going to choose sort of thing going on with a very formal, sort of uptight police detective on the one hand, Anders, and the guy that's running the cookie franchise in the mall, when there's something mysterious in his background as well.
Well, it sounds like you, even though you didn't go down the intelligence or spy novel kind of thing, it still does creep up a little bit, you know, in your fiction.
Yeah, I find that a character per book perhaps might have some usually former connection with the military. Nobody in the Readaholics. They're not military.
But it's still set in Colorado, so it could happen, right?
Yeah, they're on the wrong side of the Colorado to be military.
Okay.
I think the closest I have is one of the Readaholics, Maud, is in her mid-60s, and she's a conspiracy theorist, has a conspiracy theory blog called outtogetyou.com. So she investigates occasionally things that are related to the military or the government.
That's fun.
But yeah, nobody who's actually in the military.
So you spent 20 years in the military. What made you decide to become a writer?
Well, I was a writer before I ever went in the military.
Okay.
Not published, mind you, but I was a writer. I wrote my first full-length novel for a creative writing class in college. Sent it off to Silhouette, and they sent back a rejection like 2 years later that essentially invited me to resubmit, but I was too stupid about the business to understand that that was a really good rejection. So I, you know, cried myself to sleep, or probably ate a pint of Ben and Jerry's or something really helpful like that, and let that manuscript go. I wrote another 3 or 4 manuscripts over the next several years when I was first in the military. I had an agent for a while for a Regency romance. And then I got married, and I had a couple kids, and I took on a squadron command, and the writing kind of fell by the wayside. And I'd been in about 18 years. My husband had been in Iraq for 6 months, and he came back, and we took a weekend reunion tour in Seattle, left the kids with somebody, I'm pretty sure. Since they were 3 and 5 at the time, I'm pretty sure we left them with somebody. And we're in the Elliott Bay Bookshop in Seattle, wonderful independent store, and I'm standing in the middle of the personal essay section, and I got the most intense feeling that this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Really almost spooky kind of thing. It never happened to me before or since. And it was strong enough that I walked out of the store and I told my husband, I said, you know, I really think I'm supposed to be writing now. I'd recently been selected for promotion to colonel. The career was going well. But this feeling was so overwhelming. And he said, well, if that's what you think, you know, you should be doing, then we need to make that happen. And, you know, I won't bore anybody with the details, but I should have owed the military another couple of years for some training I'd received. And through a series of circumstances, they were looking to get rid of a couple people at, you know, specific ranks and specific jobs. And I happened to fit that niche. And the day they were the day that was the last possible day for people to leave under that program was the first possible day that I was eligible to retire.
Wow.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. So I retired one day and won a Friday.
Stars aligned.
And I turned around the next Monday and sat my butt down and started writing.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you've been to Pikes Peak Writers before, that you came as the newbie author. When was that?
Ooh, can't give you a year. I'd say probably 2003 or 4 I came. Even before I actually retired. And then I came again maybe a couple years later. Met with, very helpful editor, who at the time was at Torforge. Told him about my book. And the first thing he said was, well, you need to cut it by a third. I had a mystery. It was 120,000 words. And I thought, of course, that every one of those words was a pearl.
Sure.
We could not lose a single one without the book falling apart. But I went home and I did my usual cry for a while and eat a pint of Haagen-Dazs. And decided, okay, this guy, been in the business a long time, I'm gonna see if I can do it. And so I did. I cut 40,000 words out of that manuscript. And it's eventually the one that got me an agent. We never sold it, but it got me the agent, and other opportunities flowed as a result of that.
That's awesome.
But yeah, this is a great conference. The editors and the agents and the faculty are all very accessible. It's well run.
Yep.
Highly recommend it for newbie writers or anybody, really. I learn something every time I come here.
I was talking to a couple people yesterday, and we were chatting about how they are really good about putting the right people with the right people too. It's not like if you're a mystery writer, you're going to sit down with the horror editor.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. It's not like if you're the horror writer that they're going to sit you down with the romance writer to talk, And so it's like this gigantic mentoring program in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I think mentoring is very important. You can pick up things in conversation with people who've been there, done that, and at the very least avoid repeating some of their mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely. So did you teach anything here this year?
I did.
Faculty.
I'm faculty. I've had 3 sessions. I did one on, in the beginning, what should happen in the first, say, 5 pages of your book, what should happen and how you make it happen. I did one yesterday on plotting. I find lots of people are very plot averse, and it helps them to kind of have a structure or a sort of framework to work with. And then I'll do one later today on prologues. Do you need them? Don't you need them? And if you're convinced you need them, how do you make them work?
That's actually almost a hot topic, especially in science fiction and fantasy, because a lot of people want to do prologues, epilogues.
Right, they want to start the world building in a prologue kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there are a lot of hugely successful authors that use prologues.
Mm-hmm.
My basic sort of take on it is that prologue is one of the tools in a writer's toolbox. It's a fairly specialized tool. You're not going to pull it out as often as you pull out the dialogue or the exposition or the summary. But there are some tasks that the prologue is the right tool for. And so you got to know what those tasks are and how to use that tool to its best advantage.
That's cool. So you started out coming here as a newbie author looking for advice, and now you've come back as the published author giving the advice.
Exactly.
So you've come full circle.
Yep. I like to pay it back. I love talking to people who are excited about writing, no matter what level of their career they're at. And if anything I have to say can be helpful to someone who's, still on the journey to publication, I am more than happy to share.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And do you do any other kinds of conventions throughout the year? Do you do fan conventions where you go and you sign books and you do readings and any of that kind of stuff?
I do. I routinely do Malice Domestic, because that's a fan convention in Bethesda every year that is very specifically focused on the traditional and cozy mysteries. Those fans love their cozy mysteries, and it's a lot of fun to go and and hang out with them. I'm not doing it this year because it's next weekend. It's always first weekend in May. This is always last weekend in April. So I'm doing this instead.
Gotcha.
Most years I also go out to BoucherCon, which is a much bigger, much broader kind of crime fiction convention. Also a fan convention. It moves around. And I teach fairly, you know, I'd say 3 or 4 times a year. People bring me out. I taught at Killer Nashville last year. I teach for Mystery Writers of America. They have a program called Mystery University.
Mm-hmm.
So I teach some of the segments for them, and that travels around. I like teaching.
Yeah.
I'd much rather go somewhere and teach than go somewhere and just do a signing kind of thing.
Sure. Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you do social media. Do you have a website?
I have a website, Facebook page.
What's the website?
www.lauradesilverio.com.
Okay. I'll do a link in the show notes. I won't make you spell it out.
Okay.
And from there, people can find your social media. Are you on Twitter?
I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Goodreads and, you know, all the standard platforms.
Do you blog?
I do blog.
Yeah?
I do blog. Usually not on writing topics. I blog on whatever has taken my interest in any given day. So some of it's, you know, kind of philosophical, insightful, aging women, children going off to college, whatever sort of topics. Some of it's humorous. Some of it's writing based, but most of it's not. It's just kind of what's on my mind at any given time.
And you mentioned watching your word counts go up. What do you write in? What do you use?
Oh, I just use Microsoft Word.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, come on. What should I use?
Scrivener.
Nah. Nah. It's too structured. I just want me a blank page. And I put the words on it. I actually still do some of the writing tasks. I still prefer to do, you know, longhand on a legal pad kind of thing. My brainstorming and that sort of thing. My brain works differently if my hand is doing something than it does.
I can't do it because my brain moves faster than my hand can keep up with. And so what ends up starting out pretty good as I'm writing ends up becoming just slop that not even I can read by the time I'm done.
Well, I don't draft. I mean, I don't try to write paragraphs.
No, I mean anything. But, if I'm trying to write notes, my brain starts going a mile a minute and my hand is going, you know, a quarter of a mile, a second or so. I don't know. It's just, it doesn't work well. It's not connected well. So
no, I just have lots of circles and arrows and boxes and underlinings and stars and exclamation points and stuff. I don't actually necessarily use a lot of real words. I abbreviate everything. You know.
Well, believe it or not, we're coming up on our time.
Okay.
So this is your chance to tell people what really goes on in Area 51.
Squat all, thank you very much. Yeah, no, don't say that. That'll irritate. There's a large segment of people out there that would be very irritated if I said that.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners before I let you go?
No, just, you know, find me on the website or Facebook and drop me an email. Always like to hear from people. Really appreciate having the opportunity to chat with you. It was fun.
Good, I'm glad. It was nice to meet you.
Yeah, you too.
And we're back. Well, I hope you enjoyed that one. For me this week, you can check out my music over at johnanelio.com and follow me on Twitter at johnanelio. Patrick, how about you? What do you have going on this week?
Usual stuff. Kirkus, ATFMB is where you can find me everywhere online. And of course, SF Signal and the SF Signal podcast.
All right. Very good, everybody. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.
Pass the audition. still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?